Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Prescription-free emergency contraception. It's supposed to be available over-the-counter across the country for women of all ages. But for some, where you live matters. On today's show, we find out about the uneven access to Plan B in Native American communities. Then later in the hour, we meet a woman using graffiti in a very unique way. But first, we turn to Detroit's mayoral election. Voters in Michigan's largest city head to the polls 1 week from tomorrow. Within that race for mayor is the issue of race. There is a white candidate, Mike Duggan, former Detroit Medical Center CEO, and a black candidate, Wayne County Sheriff Benny Napoleon. As part of the Detroit Free Press endorsement of a mayoral candidate, my next guest penned yesterday's column in the Freep about the complex role race is playing in this election. Stephen Henderson is the editorial page editor for the Detroit Free Press. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So your paper endorsed Mike Duggan yesterday for mayor, and you write in your column that, here's your quote, you believe that backing Duggan reflects the more sophisticated and productive interpretation of the racial influence on this election. Explain that to us.
Well, I mean, I think the simple way to look at it is you've got one white candidate and one black candidate, and it's very easy to conclude that if you elect a white candidate in a majority black city, you are dealing a death blow of sorts to the idea of black leadership. But I happen to think that that's not going to be the case with Mike Duggan, and I drew on an experience that I had 14 years ago in Baltimore, Maryland, where we had a similar situation, a black city with a white candidate and a black candidate for mayor. The white candidate turned out to be Martin O'Malley, who went on to groom the next leader, the next generation of black leadership in that city. So there's no reason to believe that, for example, Mike Duggan, because he's white, can't deliver for us a stronger sort of cohort of potential black leaders in the future.
And as you look at the race so far, how do you see race being used in this Duggan-Napoleon competition?
Well, I mean, I think it's been a very crude dynamic. I think there are some real base appeal that Benny Napoleon has tried to make to city voters about, essentially don't turn your back on history and things like that. Sort of barely coded language that seeks to evoke a racial idea. Even Mike Duggan, whose campaign is much more sort of neutral outwardly, I think is very aware of that sort of crude dynamic and trying to avoid it. And so I think that's somewhat predictable given our history here and given the sort of hostility that race still engenders in a lot of people. But I'm hopeful that people see beyond that, and certainly in the primary, where Mike Duggan got more than double the number of votes as Benny Napoleon, it didn't seem to matter all that much.
Do you think Detroit voters has there been a sea change in the way they consider whether their mayor is black or white? I mean, did this spectacular disaster that was Kwame Kilpatrick, the hip-hop mayor, did that open more voters' minds to look beyond skin color, do you think?
I think it might have. I mean, it certainly opened voters' minds the idea that what we have been doing here for a very long time wasn't working. If you look at the last four elections, we had four elections in 2009 because of the Kilpatrick scandal and his exit from office. If you look at the results of those elections, they all sort of pointed toward the idea of change. Non-traditional candidates, people who in Detroit would have had a very hard time winning before, who did win. And so I think that's where the momentum is in the electorate. Whether it carries over into race, I think we'll learn in a week. We learned a little bit in the primary, as I said, that Mike Duggan got an awful lot of votes that I wouldn't have expected him to get. I think there is a sense of change and the need for change among Detroiters, and that plays out now at the ballot box pretty consistently.
Stephen, what does this election say, or will it say something about the state of racial affairs in Detroit, or perhaps even the state of Michigan in 2013?
Well, I think there's a milestone here, right? If Mike Duggan wins, he'll be the first white mayor in 40 years in Detroit. I don't think you can sort of blow by that without acknowledging the significance there that this means something. I think it sends a message not just to the state but to the whole nation that Detroit is not the hostile place that it often gets characterized as, that the voters here are interested in the same thing the voters are every place else. They want services, they want safety, and they're willing to get that by choosing the best person. I think that would be a rather remarkable message for the city of Detroit to send at this time when we're in the middle of bankruptcy that's getting us lots of negative attention.
Stephen Henderson, editorial page editor for the Detroit Free Press. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Yankee Air Museum has been given more time as it tries to save a part of an historic factory. The former Willow Run bomber plant in Ypsilanti is where Rosie the Riveter built B-24s during World War II. Dennis Norton is chairman of the Yankee Air Museum, and he joins us now. Hello, Dennis.
Good morning, or good afternoon, I guess it is, isn't it? Thank you.
So you have a reprieve of sorts for at least a portion of the bomber plant. What happened?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call it a reprieve. We got an extension of the time we have to continue raising funds. We've done a very good job of raising funds over the last 5 months. We've managed to account for roughly $6 million of the $8 million we need. That plus the fact that the Racer Trust, who's been very helpful to us in giving us the first couple of extensions, now knows the schedule for demolition on the plant now that they've signed some contracts on it. So they have a much better idea how long we have. So all of that together, plus just the fact that we've made such great progress so far, we talked to them and they agreed to give us another extension. This would be the last one, though, and it's important to keep that in mind because we do have demolition contracts over there now. But we do have until May 1st, and shortly after that, if we have not raised enough money, our piece of the plant will demolish also. We're quite confident that we're getting in the ballpark for this thing now.
And you're looking to save, just to remind everyone, 175,000 square feet of the plant, of that historic plant. Why fight so hard to save this piece of the plant, Dennis?
The historical significance of the bomber plant, which was a piece of the arsenal of democracy, which was Detroit during World War II, is just too important to lose. Not only did this plant produce 8,700 bombers one an hour when nobody said it could be done, but it brought great social change to the Detroit area. You mentioned in your introduction the Rosie the Riveter story. Women were brought into the workforce for the very first time in industrial plants at the Willow Run plant. It was the first place it happened. And they were brought in at equal pay, equal opportunity for advancement. And by the end of the war, over 55% were women. 42,000 people moved up here from the South and the West and the East because we didn't have enough workers here. And these people came and stayed and became a part of our social fabric in this part of the country.
And you were saying it was a pretty good weekend in the donation department, feeling encouraged. What kind of donation did you get over the weekend?
We were able to announce over the last couple of weeks, we got a couple of major donations. We were able to announce this weekend that we received a $1 million group of pledges, actually, from one person. He made a couple of pledges, longer-term pledges, but for a total of $1 million for the bomber plant campaign. That was Mr. David Robertson. We're very appreciative of his past support and his continuing support. That was a big boost for us. On top of that, we now are aware that we have a commitment from MDEQ for up to $1 million if we need it for additional environmental remediation after we purchase this piece of the bomber plant. We know there will be some additional cleaning out, nothing of any serious consequence, but in a plant this size, 175,000 square feet, the piece we're going to save, it's going to cost upwards of that much to finish up the work that Racer would be doing before we actually are able to acquire the plant. So that was very helpful.
So $2 million to go. The clock is ticking with that May 1st deadline, and we'll be
right.
following the progress as you fight to save that portion of the Willow Run bomber plant in Ypsilanti. Dennis, thank you so much. Dennis is the founder of the Yankee Air Museum and president of the Michigan Aerospace Foundation. Dennis Norton, thank you very much.
Thank you, and I encourage people to go to our website, savethebomberplant.org. We need everybody to continue helping us.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We can talk all we want about safety regulations, about child safety seats, which designs work best, and why we should have children safely restrained in a traveling vehicle. But all of the talk is trumped by the sometimes terrible realities of what doctors see in an emergency room. It's the physicians who see what happens when parents are careless about following safety laws, or when the laws themselves aren't enough to protect children. In 2012, more than 2,500 Michigan children under age 11 were hurt, and 16 youngsters died in car crashes. And that toll has not changed since 2005, despite advances in automotive design and child safety seats. So, why is this happening? Joining us is Dr. Michelle Macy with the University of Michigan C.S. Mott Children's Hospital. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Your recent editorial in the Detroit News was so full of passion on this subject, as you point out what you see as problems in Michigan's child passenger safety law. But first, will you take us into the emergency room and give us an example of a case where you think that this could have been prevented had there been greater attention to child passenger safety?
Yeah, I can. And I think that the place that we see it most often is happening in those school-age children. And families look at them and they look at their peers and they think that their kid's ready to go into a seatbelt. But when those seatbelts don't fit properly and when those kids would still benefit from a booster seat, they put the belt that's supposed to go over their shoulder behind their back, and then they're stuck with just a lap belt. And so we see injuries to their heads when they hit the seat in front of them. We see injuries to their bellies. And unfortunately, those injuries to the bellies can also go back into the spine and cause them permanent disability.
And you're pretty critical in your editorial in the news about the condition of Michigan's law. Why?
Well, the national recommendations for child passenger safety were updated in 2011, and none of the laws around the country are up to those standards yet. And I think it's probably a tricky position to be in as a legislator, and I get it as a mom of three young kids. But I think if we're using those laws as parents to guide when our kids are ready to move to the next step in terms of child passenger safety, we really need to be keeping up with those best practice recommendations.
And you're saying Michigan's law hasn't been updated for years.
Right. There was a big push when booster seats weren't being used much to get that onto the books. But now I think we've got more information about how to keep children safe in cars, and we can take it one step further and really get on the books that parents should be keeping their kids rear-facing beyond their first birthday, and that they should stay in their forward-facing car seat until they hit those weight limits, and then go into a booster seat and stay in that until that adult seat belt fits properly on every single trip.
And what is the weight limit? Spell out for us, because I know that there are people listening who may think they're doing the right thing. And I'll tell you a case in point, because I know research in technology shows that recommendations can change. We turned our baby son around from rear-facing to front-facing. We had him carefully strapped in his seat. I'm guessing 6 months or so. And this was in 1984. His baby, who's our two-year-old grandson, stayed facing rear until just recently when he literally was too long to fit. But he was over two before they turned him around.
Right. And the old recommendations that a lot of people are familiar mm-hmm. with are 1 year and 20 pounds and 4 years and 40 pounds and 8 years and 80 pounds. And if we look at all the car seats that are now available on the market in combination with those recommendations, we've got a long way that we can keep those kids rear facing up to 45 pounds in mm-hmm. some cases. They can stay in a forward facing car seat to 65 or even 80 pounds and then go into that booster seat up to 120 pounds.
Is there a movement in Lansing? Have you had conversations with lawmakers?
So from this op-ed, I think conversations are starting, and I feel like that's a really exciting opportunity. And we'll see if we can continue to generate some traction around this issue.
But all the best written laws in the world aren't worth anything if that adult doesn't follow through.
Yeah, and I think that that's a place where we need to be providing clear and consistent messages to families. And when those laws and the best recommendations don't line up, it just creates confusion. And I think people are going to go with what seems easier or fits with their prior experiences. But we know we haven't moved those death rates and those injury rates in years. And I think we can do better for kids in Michigan.
Dr. Michelle Macy with the University of Michigan C.S. Mott Children's Hospital, physician and a mom. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.
Take poetry, the spoken word. Mix in two stories of redemption, stir in a meeting at a poetry slam, and top it off with a poem about Michigan. Do all of that, and you have Kinetic Effect. They're a spoken word performing duo from Kalamazoo. Perhaps you've seen their performance of The Michigan Poem making its way around the web. They're straight from the heart piece about what it means to be from Michigan. Kinetic Effect joins us now from Kalamazoo. Kirk Latimer and Gabriel Giron, welcome to both of you. You're both making quite a mark in performance art with your poetry. You say you're two men, one voice. Gabriel, what is that one voice saying?
Well, essentially it's saying that we don't have to be held, our futures don't have to be held to our past. We oftentimes make mistakes as every, you know, teenager or young adolescent goes through life. We have to bump our heads a few times in order to figure out things. And those don't always have to define us. But, you know, unfortunately, our society is very systems-based. And too often, you know, when we bump our heads, somebody's watching. And then we get put under a microscope and we get told that we're bad people, and that dictates where we can go with our futures. And luckily for Kirk and I, we were able to do that and then fight our way through that. And really what we're trying to do is represent a voice that has been told that they'll never amount to anything, and let them know that that's not true, that you can control your own destiny.
Kirk, what's your take on your message?
Something very similar. I mean, the idea that sometimes we walk through life feeling like we are so alone in our experiences, oftentimes because we really hide who we truly are. And when we realize and express parts of ourselves that are more vulnerable, the things that we are afraid make us ugly, like our scars, for example, whether they're literal or figurative, we realize that these scars, in fact, connect us to other people, because that is the universal experience of being human. And that's the one voice I think we talk about. I mean, Gabriel and I look different, we talk different, we sound different, but when we speak together, we speak from one voice, because it is our experiences that have united us. And if we can help other people feel more comfortable sharing who they truly are, I think that more of us will realize that we're all part of that one voice.
Your nonprofit group, Speak It Forward, Inc., is aimed at lifting up and helping at-risk youth. You pour so much effort into working with young people, and it's so telling because you each had to walk a very treacherous path to get to this point of reaching out to inspire and help at-risk kids. You each made bad, even dangerous choices as teenagers, and then had to really live the message that you're preaching. Gabriel, tell us first about your struggles.
Well, I had a wonderful upbringing when I was really young. I grew up in New York until I was about seven. Parents separated. And then for 4 years, I moved, went to a different school each year. And that really changed the mindset of who I became, because I was so afraid of losing someone else. You know, I lost my dad. I lost my community. I kept losing all these friends, that I decided I didn't want to let anybody into my life. And really that brought me into a very dark space, which led to drug abuse and later drug dealing, led to a lot of criminal activity and being gang affiliated. And then I was handed a second chance opportunity. It was probably more like a ninth or tenth chance in all reality, but a really big second chance opportunity. And I took it. And it really changed the course and the trajectory of my life, as we talked about earlier, I was in the military, ended up leaving for the military, and while I was serving our country, I was diagnosed with cancer, and then ended up being stationed at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. And so the last 2 years of my service, I spent surrounded by people coming back from the war, and that even more changed the impact of what I was going through, because I realized, even though I was going through such a difficult struggle at the time, that I was still very much blessed, and that there were people who were really having hard times. I mean, I was struggling for my life, but I realized that if I was able to overcome the cancer, I would physically be able to walk out of the hospital, whereas a lot of my fellow soldiers couldn't literally walk out of that hospital. You know, they were missing legs, or they were missing arms, or they had 90% body burns from fighting for our country. And it really left a strong imprint on my mind that we need to take advantage of every second that we have, because we don't know what lies in our future. And from my battle with cancer, I was left with several scars, but two of them, one from the bottom of my neck to my sternum, and the second from my sternum down past my navel, leave me with a scar that literally makes it look like I had an autopsy. And it's the first thing that I see every morning when I go into the bathroom. And it's just a reminder. Every single day, I can't escape. I can't escape that physical scar. It's there to remind me, you're lucky to be alive. You better take advantage of it, and you better make a difference.
That's a turnaround. And Kirk, you were an English teacher?
I was an English teacher, that's right.
So tell us your story.
Well, my whole upbringing and my life is pretty much perfect.
Listen to Gabriel laughing.
Obviously, I'm the jokester. But the funny thing about it is that I think for a long period of time, I did project myself and my life as quote-unquote perfect. I think a lot of us do. And in part, that created some of my turmoil. But before then, when I was a little boy, like Gabriel, you know, I was a, you know, regular playful child, and I was super sensitive as a little boy. And it doesn't take very long in this world to realize that if you're a super sensitive boy in a world that says men are not sensitive, you start to get whittled away at, you know, beaten down, made fun of, called all kinds of names. And you start learning ways to build up walls to protect yourself, especially those who are most sensitive build up the biggest walls. And so I learned that my passion and my sensitivity could be turned into fire and anger. And I started closing people's mouths physically and defending myself. You know, how the bullied becomes the bully, so to speak. And this led to a very treacherous experience in high school. By this time, I was far more vain and far more self-centered. And I started dealing drugs, heavy, heavy drugs. And it came to a head my senior year of high school. This was the year that my high school became national news when they called it Suicide High. Because in that year, five of my friends killed themselves in a three-month time period. And it was a devastating experience. Now, oftentimes when they talk about the deaths, I mean, those that took their lives were high at the time that they did it. And the one that was really providing the drugs was, guess who? Me. And this left me with a feeling of understanding that what I had begun to do was push everyone away because of how I was hurt as a child. And then my best friend in high school at the time, he was sentenced to prison. And he actually died in prison a little over a year ago at the age of 31, zipped up in a body bag. And here I am, alive and transformed. I remember my senior staring into the casket of the youngest 14-year-old girl and thinking, oh man, I really need to change. And almost overnight I did. I went to college, ended up making it through college with superior GPA and scholarships, and I turned all that fire and all that passion into dedicated hard work. And I became an English teacher because I wanted to give to my students what no one could ever give to me. And the reality of it was, is that I had to come to terms with understanding that in order to live life to its fullest, I had to embrace and accept every part of me, including my past. Because when you ignore and you try to push away your past, that's when it becomes your ball and chain. You might think you're moving forward, but in fact, you're taking 10 steps back. And it took a lot of head bumps, a lot of hurt, and a lot of loss to realize that. And my students thank God, were the ones who helped open my eyes and actually, in fact, are the ones that got me started doing poetry and entering the competition scene, which is where I ended up meeting Gabriel.
That was Kirk Latimer speaking. He, along with Gabriel Giron, are known as Kinetic Effect, and they are using their poetry and their performance art to work with and reach out and help at-risk youth. Tell us about the programs that you do with at-risk youth. I know the Young Adult Diversion Court Program has been getting a lot of attention. What is that?
The Young Adult Diversion Court Program is a collaborative community effort to really transform the ways in which we are dealing with young adults in our court system. Normally, everything is very, you know, the high oversight of the court and the punitive way of dealing with offenders. In this case, the idea is to give young adult offenders a voice and an opportunity to work through a program that truly believes that not only are they, you know, people who deserve a second chance, but they are talented and maybe even more talented because of the things that landed them in trouble. And so what we do is we mine them for their talents and their voice, and we give them an opportunity to express it in much more productive ways than what they're used to doing. And this is because Judge Blatchford, who is the main overseer of the court who brought this program together.
In Kalamazoo.
In Kalamazoo, that's correct. Realized that, in fact, the way that we're dealing with young adults is not really working the way that it should be. And instead, we need to bring together a community effort and wrap around these young adults so that we can help make them, and not just make them, so that we can help them express who they truly are and feel like they're actually a part of a community that wants them to be there.
What do you hear from the young people back? What do you get from them, and what do they tell you about how you've touched them?
Oh, my God. I couldn't even begin to tell you the types of things that they open up about. I mean, it's just amazing. One major resounding thing that we hear is that they've never had the opportunity to truly share their voice and be heard, and that what we provide them is that opportunity to have an outlet to actually speak about their experiences and not be judged for it. But I do have to say, it's not just the youth. Mm-hmm. I mean, we perform for the youth in a juvenile home, but then we go and do the same presentation for the court officials that are governing over them or, you know, keeping them in line, and we get the same feedback. That's the craziest thing. We have this activity that allows people to open up, and I won't go into whole detail about what the process is, but what we end up with is a note card with personal information on it from them about them opening up. And you would never be able to tell, because it's anonymous, you'd never be able to tell which group it came from.
Amazing.
They are that similar. You would never be able to tell the difference of where we are. And that's the power of what we have found. And it's not like we're not creating something new. This isn't some unraveling of some new phenomenon. This is stuff that everybody has inside them. That's the beauty of it.
Gabriel Giron and Kirk Latimer are Kinetic Effect, and their nonprofit group, Speak It Forward, Incorporated, offering programs such as the Young Adult Diversion Court Program, the Speak With Fire workshops. And you can find out more about them and their work on their website, which is KineticEffect.com, and that's AFFECT, KineticEffect.com. Gabriel and Kirk, it was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Keep following the work you're doing.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are 12 recognized Native American tribes in Michigan. Some 130,000 Native Americans live throughout our state. In fact, Michigan has the largest population of Native Americans east of the Mississippi. And in that community, as well as across the nation, one of the most urgent women's health issues has been access to emergency contraception. For most American women, it takes just a trip to the drugstore and then anywhere from $30 to around $65 to get the so-called morning after pill, Plan B. The dilemma for women who go to Indian Health Services facilities? They have no retail pharmacies. So American Indian and Alaska Native women who need emergency contraception would have to deal with emergency rooms, urgent care clinics, and that usually adds up to long wait times and more money. And when you learn of the frequency of sexual assault against Native American women, this becomes very clear why this issue is so important. And although the federal government has given a verbal directive to Indian Health Services to give women over age 17 free access to Plan B, there's a lot of concern that this is not being evenly handled. Joining us to talk about this is the founder and executive director of the Native American Community Board and the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center located on the Yankton Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. Sharon Assatoyer, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you for inviting me onto your show. I certainly appreciate this opportunity to address these very sensitive issues with your audience.
And give us an understanding and a comprehensive sense, Sharon, just how important an issue this is to Native American women.
Well, there's a lot of importance here. I mean, one, we need to be treated with equal access so that we can access emergency contraceptives just like any other woman in this country. And currently, we're being treated differently. We're the only race of women that are being denied access to Plan B solely on our race. So that's a huge issue right there. Another issue is the fact that the sexual assaults are so high in our communities that there's a huge need for women to be aware that emergency contraceptive exists, for it to be offered to them, made aware of its existence by the healthcare provider that is providing services to them. And there should be really no questions asked when a woman goes up to request it.
When I saw the statistic from Amnesty USA that more than one in three Native American women is raped in her lifetime, and then you contrast that to fewer than one in five for American women overall, I was astounded, and I wondered, why is it that Native American women have to talk not about if they will become sexual assault victims, but when?
A lot of it has to do with the lack of prosecution and getting these guys off the streets. That has a lot to do with the Oliphant case, which actually took tribes' rights away from them to prosecute non-Native people in tribal court.
Now, I'm not familiar with that case.
Well, Oliphant, it stripped the tribes' ability to have jurisdiction over non-Indians in their court.
Okay.
So when a non-Indian commits a crime in Indian country, it has to be investigated by the FBI, and they're the only ones that can make an arrest. The tribal courts cannot prosecute and try this individual. It all has to be done in federal court. Another issue is the fact that until the Tribal Law and Order Act happened, we had difficulties getting the FBI to come down from their offices onto the reservations to do the investigations. And why should they if they don't have a forensic witness? One of the things that occurred in the Tribal Law and Order Act was a modification of the witness approval process. The forensic witness is usually the healthcare provider that that did the rape kit on the victim.
Mm-hmm.
The way the Indian Health Service was, a staff person that did the exam could receive a subpoena from federal court, and then it has to be approved by their service unit director, then the area director, then headquarters in Rockville, Maryland. Then it goes through the legal team and then back down the same way it came up to headquarters.
That's a pretty torturous path.
It is, and a lot of times things would just get lost in the shuffle, and then the perpetrator, the time frame would expire on his right to a speedy trial, and that was the end of the case. And so a lot of these guys know that, and they became serial rapists. When Obama signed the Tribal Law and Order Act, it said that if the witness does not hear back from their supervisor within 30 days, it is assumed that it is approved.
So that hopefully the idea would be to streamline and move things along.
Exactly, exactly.
When you say to us that Native American women are the only ones being denied access to Plan B solely on race, explain what that looks like and what that has been like for women as this has gone on.
Well, women, first of all, say you're on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation and you're sexually assaulted and you go in for some emergency contraceptives or you go in to have a rape kit done and to get medical treatment,
mm-hmm.
and you're not informed of what emergency contraceptive is.
And is that happening, where it's that uneven and that, that whole scenario actually does happen?
Well, that has happened in a lot of cases, not just on Pine Ridge. Pine Ridge is actually got pretty good medical teams. But on a lot of the other reservations, the health care providers are not providing this information, number one. Number two, if a woman knows about it and can't seek medical attention, for instance, on our reservation, up until just recently, the emergency rooms were closed. So you have to have an automobile or access to an automobile, and then you have to have gas to get you up to the nearest large town or city that carries it. Then you have to have the $50 to pay for it and then to make that round trip back home. So it could cost you $100 to $150 when you should be able to go into your local Indian Health Service facility and ask for it and be given to you, or through the rape kit process and the emergency room process, you be informed and about its accessibility, and if you decide that that's what you would like to do, given Plan B. But that doesn't always happen. We have lots of communities in our in Indian country where women do not know about it, or they have been given misinformation and believe that emergency contraceptives terminate pregnancies, like RU486. Mm. It would not be called emergency contraceptive if it wasn't a contraceptive. But the right wing, the opposition, and so on have really confused a lot of people with misinformation. So one of the things we try to do is to demystify all of these myths and to put accurate information out there into the communities.
I'm speaking with Sharon Essatoya. Sharon is with the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center and also founder and executive director of the Native American Community Board that's located at the Yankton Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. Sharon, talk to us about this verbal directive from the federal government that said, all right, Indian Health Services, give those women over age 17 free access to Plan B. Has it helped?
Well, this is really, it's a step in the right direction. I have to commend IHS for moving on that, but that occurred right after we filed a Freedom of Information Act requesting the policies that they've been promising us for over a year on access to Plan B. The only thing is that with a directive can be lost in the shuffle through, we'll say, a change of personnel. People can change their minds and rescind a directive. And so it's not a permanent solution. We want a policy because policies are much more permanent. Plus, they come with training and usually an audit. They're subject to being audited to make sure that the policy is being followed. We really want to see policies in place and not provision of Plan B on a directive.
So what's being done or what has been done already to help move toward instituting a policy, which, as you say, has training, has auditing, has a sense of responsibility?
Through the process of surveying Indian Health Service units, we know that there's a lack of consistency in the way this directive is being administered. There are some service units that still, very few, but there are still some that are not providing any Plan B at all. The majority of them are, though, however, and some are providing it to women 17 and older. Some are providing it to women 15 and older. And there's a couple in the system that are now actually providing it to women of all childbearing age, as is the Food and Drug Administration policies since this federal court case that occurred earlier in the year that mandated the removal of age restrictions. Okay, so what that's telling us is that the standardized sexual assault policies and protocols that are supposed to be in place within the Indian Health Service system is not being enforced, because if there was standardization, they would all be receiving EC as an over-the-counter based on no age restrictions. So, but that isn't happening. So what we have is a lack of continuity and consistency. And so women don't know what to expect when they go into an emergency room for services until they're there.
Sharon, can you give us a sense how the situation is here in Michigan for Native American women, both those on reservations and those who do not live on a reservation? Better off, worse off, about the same?
I think it's pretty much the same across the board. You know, you've got to look at the number of law enforcement that are on duty at any one time versus the miles, square miles and acres that they're having to patrol. The Oliphant case certainly has national impact, so it's that way on all the reservations. So it, when you think about it, it has a horrendous impact, the Oliphant case, on our day-to-day lives. From the kind of services that we get and our ability to be able to prosecute criminals. And if you don't have that ability to prosecute non-Native criminals, they know that it's open season, and so there's going to be more crimes committed. If tribes had the jurisdiction over non-tribal members, hey, the crime rate would be reduced, and we wouldn't see 1 in 3 Native women raped. So the government is definitely one of the huge factors in this. Congress could overturn the Oliphant case in a minute, but they won't. There's too much lobbying. There's too much big business behind it.
The view from the Native American community from my guest, Sharon Asatoya, who is the founder and executive director of the Native American Community Board and the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center, which is located on the Yankton Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. Sharon, thank you so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
You're welcome.
Defiant jewelry with a purpose. That's the slogan for a unique jewelry business that's been launched in the Midtown area of Detroit. It's called Rebel Nell. The goal? To turn actual pieces of graffiti found on the ground into jewelry. And the company's hiring disadvantaged women, hoping to give them a hand up from poverty and dependence. Amy Peterson is a co-founder of Rebel Nell.
It all started, actually, I went for a run one day, and I live right downtown Detroit, and so I'm very familiar with all of our beautiful graffiti. Some would probably disagree with me, but we do have some very nice murals in and around the city. And on my run, I saw some of the pieces that had been flaking off, and they had fallen on the ground. And I took a piece home, and I thought it was just beautiful on its surface. But then I realized that it was made up of all of these layers that had accumulated over the years from people tagging the same wall.
Mm.
And I thought, okay, I wonder if I can access that. And so after playing around with it for quite a bit, I was able to pull out all of the different layers that make up that single piece of graffiti. And from there, I, you know, called my business partner right away, and I said, you got to go over here. I think we've got something incredible. And that's kind of how the whole thing started.
Tell us how you and your business partner, Diana Russell, developed that idea of taking this jewelry-making business and turning it into a way to fight poverty for these women.
Yeah, we both are very proud Detroiters. We love the city, and we both have, you know, our two passions are the love of the city and empowering women. It's something that we both feel very strongly about. We had the idea to develop this jewelry business with that in mind. We work closely with a lot of the local shelters in the area, and what they're missing is a transitional opportunity. There's a lot of recidivism, and these women aren't given opportunities to try and make a better life for themselves. So we wanted to provide that. And it was then that we discovered, you know, the graffiti and how beautiful it could be. And we think there's a lot of symbolism with what we're doing in the graffiti. You know, just like Detroit on its surface, it's not the prettiest when you first look at it, but it is, if you take the time to look at it, it's made up of all these amazing ideas and people that are absolutely beautiful. And we think the same way of the women that we're going to be hiring.
So you're going to train them to make the jewelry?
Yep, we're going to train them. We're also going to be teaching them life management skills, so it's not just, you know, the skill of making jewelry. We want them to have the confidence to pursue their own dreams. So we'll be giving them a paycheck. We'll also be teaching them, like I said, life management skills such as how to set up a bank account, how to establish credit. We'll be bringing them with us on these different trade show events so that they can learn to interact with customers. And we really want them to be encouraged by this whole process so that maybe in 2 to 3 years we understand that each woman will grow differently. But we're hoping that they can come to us and say, you know what, Amy and Diana, this has been an amazing experience, but I've had a true passion for fill in the blank. And we want to be like, great, okay, let's get you lined up. We want to be able to, you know, have these phone calls and resources available where we just pick up the phone and say, we've got another one coming for you. And you know, we set them up with their business structure, or maybe it's continuing their education, or maybe it's even being promoted from, you know, inside Rebel Nell. So these are all things that we, you know, are hoping to accomplish.
Where did the name Rebel Nell come from?
So we really wanted to pay homage to a strong, powerful woman in history that's influenced both of us. And so we kept bouncing names back and forth, and the one that really resonated with both of us is Eleanor Roosevelt. We thought she was such an amazing humanitarian, advocate for civil rights, outspoken for women's rights. And her nickname that her father gave her was Little Nell. We thought she was worthy of a stronger nickname, so we came up with Rebel Nell. And we also are using, you know, an art form that is traditionally rebellious in nature with the graffiti.
Amy Peterson of Rebel Nell, we will be following your progress, and good luck. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. And let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.